Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who this week irked a postman, is Richard Herring. Oh yeah, you should have killed me last year. Welcome to another series. It's still going on. I don't know, it's got recommissioned, I don't know how, to a new series, series 11. Of Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was hanging around with Platinum from the Blazing Squad. And we met down by the crossroads. That's where we met up. He calls it Rahelasibus. I don't know if that's going to catch up. And yes, very, I did this week, I irked a postman. Weirdly enough, if you listened, there was an audio special from the Wells Comedy Festival, and one of my new emergency questions was, have you ever irked a postman? And I hadn't irked a postman when I came up with that question, but since doing that podcast, I irked a postman, and he was very irked, I have to say, and it was your fault, because I'd spent all week signing these new emergency question books that are available from GoFasterStrike.com, 500 questions plus, that you can entertain your friends and family with, and I'd agreed to sign and add extra questions to about 200 of these. And then I had all these envelopes, and I kind of just posted them all in the post boxes near my house and filled all the post boxes up. And I kind of thought, I did it at night, and I thought, oh, they'll come in the early in the morning and empty the post boxes, because I remember the 1970s when there used to be more than one postal collection. And then about 5 o'clock in the evening, I went out with, I had 10 bags of these, bag for life bags of these things that I had to deliver. They've closed down all the post offices in Shepherd's Bush. So I wasn't going to take... I took two of them to the post office, but it would have been 5 miles to take all of them to the post office and back. And so I went and I saw him at the van. I ran up and said, oh, mate, can you put these in the van? He went, no, fuck off. You're very selfish. You're a very selfish man. Why have you done this? And I irked him. We had a long... I might turn it into a routine for my new show, Over Again 50, because 10 years ago I had a fight with a university lecturer on the streets of Liverpool as I was entering my midlife crisis. It was quite embarrassing. It's a long story, but it was basically his fault, and he'd been unpleasant, and he sort of attacked me, and so I fought him back and went to fight him before I remembered that I didn't really know how to fight. And we just sort of windmilled around about a fire. I kicked him in the balls quite a lot, and I did punch him in the head once. It was brilliant. Really, if you've never punched anyone, do punch someone. It's fucking great. And I had all my shirt ripped off me, and he got, sort of ran away, and the police came, and then they sort of were laughing at me. And I got in the cab to leave, to go back to my hotel, and the cab driver in Liverpool genuinely said, "That was the funniest fight I've ever seen." So it's quite different. 10 years on, nearly 50, I'm a King Postman. So if you are at home, do please... check out this. We'll do some questions from it, I'm sure, during the show, so you'll get to see this. We've got a new question book. The Lannister book is full, and this is a Tiny Rick book, which in Wales no one knew what that was, and I'm disappointed in London no one knows. It's Tiny Rick. Tiny Rick. Yeah, come on, man. Rick and Morty, you've got to like that. So let's crack on, because we've got quite a good first guest, and so I'll stop blathering on. My first guest of the new series, he's probably best known as a panellist on the panel show Scruples from 1988. We'll find out today why he's never done any panel shows since then. I don't know what happened to put him off. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please welcome my guest tonight, Paul Merton, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Merton, here he is. Sit down. Paul Merton. Sit here, pull up, hold a microphone like in the old days. Paul Merton, it's Paul Merton! Paul, bloody
thank
Merton.
You, thank you very much.
So, we'll get out of the way, because I'm sure you get asked about this all the time, but what do you remember about the performing in Scruples?
I met John McVicar.
Did you?
Who was, John McVicar in the 60s was on the front cover of the tabloid newspapers as the most dangerous man in Britain. He was a bank robber, and he did use shotguns. He didn't fire them, but he sort of had them in his hand when he walked into the bank and threatened to use them. So he was sort of seen as a violent man. He then left prison and then sort of, I think he studied sociology or something, or got a degree. And then, so I knew this, he was a guy that was doing this program. So I met him. And I realized that sort of, it's a class thing really, but I had, in a strange way, because he was from sort of Clapham and I was sort of near sort of that sort of area. I had more in common with him than I did with, say, like Stephen Fry.
Right.
You know, even though he was a bank robber, John McVicar, not Stephen Fry.
Yeah. He did that credit card thing, though, didn't he, Stephen
yes,
Fry?
He did.
So he was, but it was a bit of a wrong-un as well.
But it's the sort of... it's the one of the working class ways out, you know.
Yeah.
But, it was interesting. And I met Nicholas Parsons, and from that I sort of... inveigled my way into being invited onto Just a Minute. So yeah. It all sort of worked out, you know.
Yeah, that's nice. Good.
You do these things for a reason. If it works out, it's great.
Anyone remember Scruples, the TV show Scruples?
No.
Yeah, it's got a lot of some big fans of Scruples, and I didn't remember that one. I've been reading your autobiography all weekend, which is quite unusually. I just read the first bit when I've got a guest, and then...
And then blag it.
Yeah, blag it from there. But yours was pretty good, so I read the whole thing. It's... called Only When I Laugh, and it's very well worth reading. It's very it's funny, but it's also rather emotional, and there's some beautiful bits in it as well. But I'm quite interested in those early days of stand-up, which I will always go back to. But you were there as a punter, really, right at the beginning of alternative comedy.
Yes, it was sort of the history of comedy as we see it today is very much affected by the opening of the Comedy Store in 1979. It's still running up and down, you know, opposite the Prince of Wales Theatre it is now. But when it opened in 1979, essentially it was a democracy. It was a gong show, which meant that anybody could get up on stage, anybody here could go along to the Comedy Store, give your name to the compere, and go up on stage. And if you were funny, the audience laughed. If you weren't funny or nervous, there was a gong and off you went, and that was it. But for those people that could sort of get through that sort of baptism gong by fire, as it were, it's a chance to be on stage, because you can want to be a comedian, you can want to be in comedy, but until you get stage time, until you're really in front of an audience, it's all theory.
Yeah.
So that's because when I wanted to be a comedian from a very early age, when I was about four or five, I saw clowns at Olympia, Bertram Mill Circus, I think it was. Just after the war, the circuses were huge, huge live entertainment. And it still went into the early 60s. So when I saw it, it was about 3,000 people in this huge, massive tent at Earl's Court, Olympia. I suppose it was inside the building there rather than a tent. It was obviously the exhibition hall. And I'd never been anywhere where 3,000 people gathered. I used to go to a church on Sunday. It was my parents' idea, and I had to go along with them. And that was always just boring and Latin and smelt of incense. And here was sort of like adults who previously I thought were people who said, no, don't do that. Come down. No, leave that alone. Suddenly they had big boots. They had colourful hair that went up at the side. They drove cars where the doors fell off. They threw sausages at each other. They ran towards the audience with a bucket of water that turned out to be confetti at the last minute. And just hearing the sound of thousands of people laughing was a pivotal moment in my life.
Right.
Absolutely. And I wanted to be part of that machine that created that laughter.
Yeah, yeah.
I would have been very happy to have been the guy that walked on and picked up the wheels of the car and then ran off with them again just to clear the ring.
Yeah.
That would have been a fantastic job. You know. So I was completely hooked by that one moment, really. It really was something.
And then so you left school. I mean, it's interesting, but the book goes through all this, but you're at school and obviously there's no... I mean, I was the same. I mean, there's a lot of similarities because I was very obsessed with comedy. You're actually almost exactly 10 years older than me.
Yes.
You're about to turn 60.
Yes, I am.
In
yes.
3 days before I turn 50. We'll never be on the same decade as each other. No, we'll never be able to compare notes.
Life's a real fucker, isn't it? I hope that hasn't brought too many people down. I wasn't expecting to get this emotional this early.
We'll maybe talk about that later, at school, you know, going to comprehensive schools, there was no real path. I mean, I had the same thing as you. I think you go to the careers officer and they're giving you I think they wanted me to work in a bank and they wanted you to stack shelves.
Well, there was no sort of, like, before the comedy store in 79, you had your options to become a comedian were to perhaps get into Cambridge Footlights, because people had done that in the past. It was Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Alan Bennett, Jonathan Miller, holiday camps. I mean, Dave Allen started off doing holiday camps as a red coat back in the early 60s, because that was one of the options. Fringe theatre wasn't really something that, you know, you couldn't... Northern men's clubs, working men's clubs in the north, that wouldn't have been any good. So it really was sort of the... Not for me, you know. I mean, as a 19-year-old boy, a very shy boy from Morden, end of the Northern Line, imagine me on stage in Manchester. Get the fuck off that stage if you're not going to make us laugh. Come on! The stripper's on in 5 minutes. She gets paid by the hour. Now, come on, move on. You know, I would have died within instant. You know, it wouldn't have. You know, that would have been it. It was. I can't remember what the question was now, but we sort of got there in the end.
There was no avenue through, was there?
There were no other avenues through. There's also a poverty of ambition at school. I remember sort of a kid. One day, the maths teacher said to the class, he said, "Okay, this was in the sixth form. I'm going to go around and ask you what you're going to do when you leave school." And he turned to this one boy in the front row who was sitting next to his friend, and he said, "This boy said, what are you going to do?" He says, "I'm going to work for Sunlight Laundry." And the teacher says, "Well, why are you going to work for them?" He says, "Well, they're just down the end of my road." And the teacher said, "That is the most pathetic answer I've heard in 35 years of teaching. You're going to get a job. You're going to base your career at the end of school, something at the end of your road. That's awful." He turned to the kid next to him and said, "What about you?" He says, "I'm going to work with him." You know, it was true.
But so you were quite shy.
Yes, but that does seem to be a sort of a contradiction. But shy people, initially who are shy, are quite good. Well, are drawn towards performance, because although there's a large number of people as there are here, I'm speaking as, you know, I'm on the stage, I've got a microphone, I'm not speaking one to one in a room somewhere. So it's easier to be, I suppose, exhibitionist is to be fair, in front of a crowd, an audience, rather than individuals.
Sure, but you were listening. You were listening to comedy records and. Mm. And we're having lots of, you had films you project onto your wall. And
yes.
So you were kind of very...
Trying to absorb a comedy, whichever medium it was, P.G. Woodhouse books or whatever, you know.
Sure, sure. And I was interested, this is just on a sidebar for me, that you made your own snooker table.
Yes.
Did you play with ping pong balls?
Yeah, they haven't got a lot of weight to them, so you've got to hit them quite hard to make the move. It was a sort of Sabutio table football pitch, you know, sort of thing. So you're green beige and you put books down and sort of with gaps between them for the pockets. And the end of a golf club, you'd not, you know, it was...
Did you play against any other people or did you just play against yourself?
It was always interesting to play a really difficult snooker, which you then had to try and get out of.
Yeah.
You know, so that was quite fun.
I still do it as an adult. That's one of my other podcasts. I'll get you on that one sometime. Be confused.
Sounds good.
Now. Yeah, I played myself at snooker in another podcast. Don't worry.
On a full-size table?
No. Well, 6x3 is regulation self-playing snooker size.
6x3.
It's the regulation. I use proper balls not made out of ping-pong balls.
Well, yeah. But 6x3, you know.
But you saw...
That's like they sell that under my first junior snooker table. Label.
The one that I bought, I did a couple of frames on tour this last tour,
yes.
In the interval, and I started to buy a snooker table in, and it was only when I got it onto the stage I realised it was sort of at the height for a 5 year old.
Yes.
But I was playing for about 5 minutes before I realised I am quite small, so you know it suited me. Anyway, so you gave up your job in the civil service to have a cracker.
This is like This Is Your Life, isn't it?
Yeah, I've got a little.
Do you recognise this voice? I had to fuck off the Canada to get rid of him. It's Uncle Ernie.
But you saw all these early days at the comedy store.
Yes.
So you saw Alexis Sale as the.
Alexis Sale, yeah, at the comic strip, which was shortly after the comedy store because Don at the comedy store wasn't paying anybody. And so they formed the comic strip. That's how it first started. And they played the Raymond's Review Bar.
Yeah.
And Alexi was extraordinary. It was, I suppose, half the size of where we are now. Maybe it's like an 80-seater or something. And a tiny stage, but he was this sort of... This would be 1981, 82, 81, I think. And he had this very tight suit. And this pork pie hat, Liverpudlian. Really sort of quite sort of... Not fat, but muscular. Stocky, I think, is the right word. And at this point, this was still when we had, you know, with the exception of someone like Biddy Connolly, who, you know, there was, you know, Des O'Connor, and it was light entertainment kind of sort of stand-up is what you had. And so there was Alexi doing these jokes with the most improbable punchlines. I live in Stoke Newington. I work for a magazine. Do you know the magazine what's on in Stoke Newington? It's written on the front page, fuck all. You know... Another one was, I thought to myself, I might dress as a clown, you know, get great big boots, paint my face white, have a red nose, and I thought to myself, he did fuck all for Mussolini. Never heard a gag before where the punchline was Mussolini. You know, extraordinary. It's great being Jewish, you know, because you can just make up names, you know, for holidays, and they don't know at work, you know. You can say, I can't come into work today, it's a hacker day, I've got to sit in the back garden with a pork pie on my head. And it was the anger in which he uttered pork pie, you know, like, pork pie, you know, it was astonishing.
Yeah.
And one routine, which doesn't sound particularly witty, but got to the point where you were just really just begging him to stop because it was just, you were laughing so much. And it was, I think he called it stream of tastelessness. And basically, it's just like every single swear word, nothing else. Say it over and over again, repetitive, and getting faster and faster. So we just start off with something like, fuck, shit, wank, gun, bollocks, and get faster and faster over the course of a minute as his arms started pumping. It was the funniest thing you'd ever seen in your life. Because it was utterly pointless, relentless, scary... completely no material at all, but just really just went for it, and it was an astonishing moment.
Yeah.
That was something that Alexi had never thought of being a comedian. The comedy store was opened up, as I said, in 79, advertised, do you think you can be a comedian on the underground and stuff like that, and Alexi was one of the people that turned up, you know.
There was sort of an astonishing array. I mean, we were talking about a little bit about this backstage, because I started doing on the circuit in about 1990, and there was still a little vestige of this left. But there was a lot of speciality acts and basically crazy people, or people doing just what, you know. There was a guy called the Iceman who was still going when I was going. Who
yes.
Just melted a block of ice by lying on it for 20 minutes.
That was the act. It was 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Sometimes if the air conditioning was particularly fierce, it might take over an hour. But he would use a mini blowtorch and thing. That was, people would book him. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, it was.
But you mentioned someone. Hubert and Hilary Haddock.
Hilary Haddock. Yes, that was Fish and Fire Fantasy.
Right.
They would, I mean, this was, because most of these acts, when the original people like Alexei Sell, Rick Mell, Aid Edmondson, Nigel Planer, you know, all the young ones guys, stopped playing the Comedy Store, there was a gap. There was a venue that was open for, you know, one night a week, but no acts. So that's where the Covent Garden acts started to come in. So they were, none of them are really stand-ups. They were, by the nature of being sort of, you know, open-air acts, they're visual, lots of whistling goes on to grab attention and stuff, and just doing crazy things like setting your hat on fire and all this kind of thing. And one of the things that Hubert and Hilary Haddock did, and the Fish and Fire Fantasy, they came out to their theme music was, I mean, cause this was another difference, because comedians don't really, these days particularly, they bother with theme music, entrance music particularly, I suppose it's called. We don't really bother with it, do we? But they had this sort of like March of the Mods by Joe Loss, which was that sort of beat to it. And they come on holding sprats in their hands, dressed in sort of like, I suppose sort of semi sort of like Knights of Arabia costumes, you know, silk sort of balloony trousers and blouses and stuff. And the Fish and Fire Fantasy was basically them sort of, you know, eating fish off each other's stomachs and things like this. And just before they came on one night at the Comedy Store, a man who was sitting, this is why you should always be careful when you heckle somebody, to have a quick look round. This guy shouted out to the compere, "Give me some variety." Now, just seconds after he said that, he found himself being whacked across the face with a sprat. Being welded by a man who looked like he'd come out of sort of 1001 Arabian Nights. He said, well, he wanted some fucking variety. How about that? And they went on and did, you know, I was at the vegetarian restaurant in Highgate where they were banned because they were doing fish. You know, it was sort of, you know, it was a visual stuff.
Did they throw them into the audience?
Yeah,
as well?
you always.
Must have been a quite annoying thing.
Yeah, you've always put them on last.
Yeah. But then, you know.
Then the audience can go home not sitting there amongst sprats. You know, like doing a gig on a trawler or something. Here comes the net again, Ray.
But then you came up with the, you know, you went up and did the Gong Show and
my confidence was not so strong that I waited till the Gong Show stopped because I didn't I desperately wanted to be on stage. What I didn't need to be was on stage, not having confidence and somebody shouting something out. And go, oh fuck, that's made it even harder. So it was only when the policy was eventually dropped, because there were better people coming. It was one night when Alexei got gonged. You know, he said, "You can't gong me, I'm the fucking compere." You know. And so it could sometimes get out of hand if you give the audience, if they're a bit pissed, if you give them too much control, then suddenly people that are good are getting gonged off, you know. So it became a sort of, in the end, I mean, they still do it as a sort of once a month Monday thing, you know, but that's better than doing it all the time.
Yeah. Do you remember the act, the LSD policeman?
Yes, there was a moment. I suppose I can probably call it a moment of inspiration. I was waiting for a bus. That wasn't the moment of inspiration because I've seen other people do it over the years. And it was raining a bit like tonight. And I suddenly remembered this thing popped. I just amused myself. I was standing at this bus stop in the rain, waiting for a 118 bus, and I started talking like a kind of sort of. Comedy stock policeman. Oh yeah, what are you doing in standing in the shop window? It's all ready now. What's going on here? And I just stood up just to myself, and then out of nowhere, I suddenly remembered a documentary that I'd seen about 5 years before. I think it happened in Wales. There was a police operation called Operation Julie, where essentially they busted this LSD making factory somewhere in 1977. I think it was Wales, and these coppers, not knowing what was going on, went in and busted this hallucinogenic LSD factory and inhaled the dust, ingested the dust. And then after the successful arrest, a couple of them went to the pub. And then this was in the documentary, the bit I remember. So these two men are in the pub, these two policemen, and one bloke is looking straight into the camera and he says, I was having a pint of beer with Detective Inspector Norris. Well, I noticed that my pint of beer was getting bigger. And I immediately saw the comic contrast between hallucinations where anything can happen and the down-to-earth copper who's bemused by it. And this was shortly after the Brixton riots in 1981. It was 81, yeah. And so this was the first thing I did. I'll try and remember it as much as I can. So essentially, I came on. I had a pair of pyjamas on, a pair of striped pyjamas. I had one of those policeman's helmets that you buy in tourist shops, you know, little plastic policeman's helmet. Just to sort of, again, to be sort of kind of... I wasn't sure whether I'd be funny, But I thought what I was saying would be funny, and I thought if I looked visually funny or interesting, then it helped. Well, it all helps, you know, your first time on stage. So it went very well. I came on and I said, on Wednesday, I was a policeman giving evidence in court. So it's also meant that I could have the notebook there in case I forgot the words. So I try to remember, think of everything to conquer nerves if they happened. So here was something like this. On Wednesday, 14th of October last, while Pat rolling along Streatham High Road, I observed a motor vehicle illegally parked outside the all-night Clement Attlee massage parlour. I questioned the occupant, who said, "Urinate off, you effing love child." The driver then apologised and offered me a yellow, candy-covered chocolate confectionery known to the uniformed branch as a Smartie. I accepted the Smartie and swallowed it. A Smartie I now know contained an hallucinogenic drug. 35 minutes later, while sitting aboard an intergalactic spaceship bound for the planet Zanussi, I observed Constable Parrish approaching me disguised as a fortnight's holiday in Benidorm. "Hello, Constable Parrish," I said out of the back of my neck. "And what news of my Lord Buckingham?" To which Constable Parrish replied, "You stupid git, get down off that bus shelter, you stupid git." I then ate Constable Parrish. I was enticed down from the bus shelter by the very lovely Miss Marilyn Monroe, former screen starlet. We kissed informally until Marilyn, sweet, tender Marilyn, revealed herself as Mr. Brinsley Okobo, scrap metal dealer from Peckham. A panda patrol car flew past and three large uniformed pandas got out. I was charged by Chief Constable Warren of gross indecency, impersonating a Spaniard, acting the goat and eating a police constable while in the course of his duty. I burst into hysterical laughter, which lasted 5 months. And that was basically it. That was it.
It's a very intricate and it's very well-written routine as well.
I took 6 weeks to write it once I had the initial idea. Yeah. Sitting in the bedsit, you know, over and over again, because again it was the idea. It was about 3.5 minutes long, I think.
Yeah.
And the idea was that every line is either a joke line or lead into a joke line. So even if I'm not funny, if what I'm saying is funny, then... And the thing was, it was, you know, because it's a difficult job to do and it's very easy to be put off, you know, when you're not doing very well. But that first gig at the Comedy Store, which was just that 3.5 minutes at the end, going on at 1:30, I mean, it stormed it, you know. It went really well, and you know, they wanted me back on again. I went back on and did it again. There was nothing. I had no other material. And I walked all the way home from Soho, from Wardour Street, all the way to Streatham. I got back about 7 a.m. It was around about April time, and it was just... I mean, that got me through every bad gig over the next 18 months, which there were many, because I couldn't live up to my opening. It was, I had some good jokes, but nothing that was as strong as that for ages.
And, you know, you're playing to an audience who usually saw people melting ice and throwing fish around.
Well, exactly.
You know, they must have been amazed you could talk.
The fact... he's impersonating somebody else.
But it's sort of also interesting, because it's a little bit of the persona, the Paul Merton persona.
Yes, I realised, I thought that the policeman mustn't find what he's saying funny.
Yeah.
Because he wouldn't. And also, it's a kind of sort of... without really thinking about it, that did kind of set a sort of stamp, I suppose, because it was the most successful thing, first, very early on, that I did. Probably the most successful thing I ever did in stand-up, certainly. It was because it was one of those things, again, when you're watching television, when you're growing up, and you're trying to work out the theory of what it is, you know. But there are no rules in comedy, because every exception, everything you think of, there is an exception. I mean, generally speaking, I didn't like growing up comedians that laughed at their own stuff, you know. But Billy Connolly does, and Billy Connolly is an exception, you know. He's an extraordinary comedian, one of the biggest, most influential comedians of the last, since the war. So you can't say it's wrong because he does it, you know. I found that if there's a sort of you say something that's like, my favourite line in the whole thing was, I saw Constable Parish came towards me disguised as a fortnight's holiday in Benidorm.
Yeah,
if you look puzzled as to why people are laughing, or embarrassed, or slightly humiliated, it just makes it funnier.
Yeah.
That's the idea anyway.
No, it's a brilliant...
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I love the books, honestly, about your teenagers and your obsession with comedy, which, you know, I think like a lot of comedy fans do feel like, I did as well, you feel isolated because everyone else is into pop music, which you were later, but you
yes,
weren't at the time.
Yeah.
And so you listen to comedy records and sort of obsessing over comedians, and it's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, compared to other people. But,
yeah, it is. It can be nice. A bit sort of, I mean, magicians, you know, they tend to sort of, when they're adolescents, they tend to stay in bedrooms practicing card tricks over and over again on their own. And people who are into comedy listen to Hancock CDs or whatever it would be these days, you know. But it's just, it's incredibly fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why does a line... There is a line in Round the Horn. Now, you know, they did the show here, didn't they, about 10 years ago, recreation of the radio series Round the Horn. Now, Kenneth Williams and Q Paddock are playing two camp characters called Julian and Sandy. And the guy, Kenneth Horn, comes round to visit them. And this is a joke which, on paper, it doesn't appear to make sense. And it's only the rhythm of the performers, which I'll try and approximate if I can, that gets it across. So Kenneth Horn is in there, and he's inquiring about theatre tickets. And he says, what else have you got? And they say, well, there's your actual... Hang on, let me think. I always remember the punchline, because you always get that right, and then you're okay. But let me just figure out the... yes, that's it. He says, so Kenneth Horn says... So anything else you're interested in? He said, Mozart. He said, please yourself, and he booked the seats. Now, it doesn't mean anything, yeah. Mozart, please yourself, we only booked the seats. But in the hands of Kenneth Williams, in his voice, the audience roar.
Yeah, yeah.
Mozart, please yourself, we only booked the seats. As I've proved, it means very little. But that's the exchange, and it worked. So why does that work? It's the persona of Kenneth Williams. It sounds sort of... Perhaps it sounds rude, and it isn't rude. It's the name of a composer, but in a rule book, it wouldn't make sense. But it, just the rhythm of it, the lines of it, the whatever. You know.
Well, I think that's what's fascinating about comedy, because like one line in the, you know, with one comedian will be incredibly offensive, and people will be very upset about it, and a different comedian can say exactly the same thing, and people will love it. It's about how you feel about the person, I suppose. It's about the persona of the. It's the relationship you've built up with an audience. So someone like Barry Cryer can say something that's really filthily upsetting, but his audience will still love him for it, you know.
But half of them won't know what it means.
They won't, and they'll hear it again in 5 minutes. But my favourite one of these was your obsession with Michael Crawford.
Yes.
I just think this is...
Well, it's funny how sort of history sort of remembers people. Now, when the first series of, I don't know how many people of my age are out there, but 1975, I think it was the first series of this programme, Some Mothers Do Have Them, which, this was long before Impressionists got hold of the character, and Mike Yarwood particularly sort of simplified it a bit. But his, the extraordinary visual gags, the stunts, the thing with the mini hanging off the edge of the cliff, the roller skating underneath the lorry, the going around on roller skates and shooting out the door, the coming down the stairs on the wardrobe, all these sort of stunts done in front of a live audience were exhilarating.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, this is in a sort of world of... I mean, the 70s was a very strong decade for sitcom, incredibly strong. Steptoe and Dad's Army and Porridge and whatever. But Some Mothers Do Have Them really stood out as well as being sort of like a bit of a throwback to sort of the visual days of Keaton or Chaplin or whatever. But before it kind of got sort of mangled a bit, it was really sort of something.
Yeah,
yeah, it was astonishing.
Yeah,
it, so it seems difficult to believe that now, maybe.
Well, I remember it. I used to love it as a kid. There was a sort of childishness to that character.
Oh yeah, totally.
But you read it in a paper that Michael Crawford,
yes,
would go for a run every morning. In
the park. Around Hyde Park, and Hyde Park, as you all know, is a huge park. So I would. One morning, I went and sat on a park bench waiting for him to run past me. My parents had gone away, I think, on holiday without telling me. No. And I was just on my own, and I sort of. He was in this huge musical at Drury Lane called Billy, which is a magnificent book by Keith Waterhouse, but it's kind of my story, but set in the North. So it seems impossible for him because he's in the North, and he meets a comedian, and Billy Lyre, will he come to London, and that's the whole thing of it. So it was kind of, and I saw him, and Michael Crawford, exhilarating stage performer. I mean, just really, booked by Clement Lafrenet, the people who wrote Porridge, Likely Lads, music by John Barry. So it was a really good, classy, it was an incredible, classy production. And I was just hooked on it. I read somewhere in an interview, I go running to Hyde Park every morning. So I just sat on a bench near the Royal Albert Hall and got there about 6:30 in the morning and waited to about, I don't know, probably 8:30, 9:00 maybe. No. You know, you thought, well, he's not going to be out running now, is he?
And then he just ran.
Oh, well, that's somebody running towards me. And he's got a blue... No, that's not him. But then you sort of... Even if he had a run past, which would be unlikely, of course... I wouldn't have said anything. I'm certain. What would I have said that would have said to him, I tell you what, come and be in the show tonight, or whatever, whatever you imagine it's going to be. But it was just like, it's like contact with somebody that did it, but it's I was bitten too overawed at that time.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I think that feels to me like a play. There's another instance that's a bit like a play, but that feels like a play where the young Paul Merton... it's waiting for Michael Crawford. It's sort of like just a play of the young Paul Merton waiting for Michael Crawford, who never shows up, or maybe just as you leave the bench, he runs past.
That would be good.
And says, ooh, Betty.
That would be good.
But also, there's another play that I think's there to be written, which is Stuart Lee once went to interview Spike Milligan in his house, but Spike Milligan was having one of his episodes.
Yes.
So Stu sat downstairs for 2 hours waiting for him to calm down, and talking to his wife, and then in the end his wife said, you're just going to have to go, he's not going to be able to interview you. So that's kind of an that almost meeting of two generations. But I know you met Spike.
He was on a cycle, so it depends on where you were. He got shell-shocked in the war and stuff, and so he was sort of... Yeah, I mean...
But it's sort of that, it's that near meeting of those... It's interesting when it's two different generations, I think, as well. But that, Stuart Lee and Spike Milligan nearly meeting and then not meeting. And
yes.
Paul Merton and Michael Crawford, who I presume you've met subsequently.
No, never.
Maybe not.
No, never, no.
Oh. He goes running in Hyde Park. You should go and wait down there.
I don't wish to be mean, but does he still go running? It is sort of funny when you saw... I mean, I was a huge Man from U.N.C.L.E. fan, and I met Robert Vaughan. He came down to the Comedy Store, and it was unbelievable to meet Robert Vaughan. But you meet sort of... occasionally meet famous people, and it is always a surprise when they know who you are. I mean, it shouldn't be, perhaps, if you're... But I don't often go to where there are famous people. So Richard Attenborough... Richard Attenborough came up to me and said... I mean, I didn't know what to do with my face in the middle of this... Because I thought we were going one way with this sentence, and it ended up somewhere else. So my face had a sort of contortion in the middle where I had to sort of change expression quickly, and he said, you have made me pee myself with laughter. Mind you, I have got diabetes.
Uh,
I mean, you wouldn't imagine that in a million years, would you? But this is what Richard Attenborough would say to you. I mentioned it on Have I Got News for You the other week. I don't know if it went out. I didn't see that episode in the edit. But Roger Moore. I met Roger Moore. For me, Roger Moore was the saint, you know, and then later, of course, James Bond. I was at some sort of film award magazine do. Roger Moore, I think, perhaps recognised me and so came over to speak to somebody that he recognised. He made a beeline for me. And as he got to me, he just looked at me and said, I can hear fuck all in his ear. I mean, if you were given a selection of the things he's going to say, you wouldn't pick that one out, would you? Funny though.
But I had a similar thing with you of the sort of hero worship thing, because I was massively obsessed with the comedy I saw on TV, and then I saw you do a very that I was very obsessed with. You did an early stand-up set, and I'd never seen anything like it because I'd been watching Python and stuff that was all scripted. And then something happened in the audience and you did this big... Suddenly veered off and did this.
Yes,
you remember the bit, don't you? Because it's about the coach part. I did talk to you about it once. I can't remember what the subject, but I was just blown away because something happened and you clearly ad-libbed this really funny bit and I couldn't believe. And then, you know, then it came to being like 1991 and I'd been invited to the Light Entertainment, BBC Light Entertainment Christmas party because we'd done On the Hour that year. And then you were, you know, the Beverly Sisters were there, kind of incredible, you know, this...
The Beverly Sisters, yeah.
An incredible array of people from, you know, hundreds of years of show.
You get extremely excited, because, I mean, if you don't know who these people are, obviously it's not exciting, but you see Kenneth Wolstenholme talking to Leslie Phillips. Yeah. You just think there's a combination. I don't know, it's because we don't think of them as being real people, and suddenly they're talking to each other outside of each other's boundaries.
I think it's just very exciting, when you're thrust into that world, it's very exciting, but you were there, and then, but I was much too nervous to talk to you until I was very drunk.
Yes.
And then I came up to you and sort of stood there grinning and saying whatever inane thing I said. Mm. And then the next year, I did the same thing again. So I think for two or three years, I would just come up to you.
How many years do you think you did that for?
Quite a long time.
You're saying three or four?
I think it was quite a while.
There was a gap for a couple of years and you came back strong again.
I'm amazed I've got through this far without having had to have a drink to get me to the point where I could talk to you.
But you were
very nice to me, given that I was this sort of dweeby little comedy fan kind of coming up.
The thing is, you should be. You know, I can remember sort of like this is there's a footballer. Chelsea had a team in the 70s that were sort of a classy team, not as like they are now, but they weren't winning things, but they were a classy team. They had stars like Peter Osgood. There was a swagger about the King's Road Chelsea. Now, there was a player for them called David Webb, who was like a solid centre-half. That's all you need to know about him. So near where I live, Chelsea trained. So one Monday afternoon, somebody said, let's go down with the autograph book. So we went down with the autograph book, and the big players came out from from training, and they'd been in the shower, and they got into their cars, and they drove off, and nobody would sign anything. One guy, the captain, Ron Harris, just signed RH, and he was afterwards going, well, if he can sign RH, why can't he sign Ralph, why can't he sign Ron Harris? Why can't he do his real name? You know, and David Webb came out, and there was like 10 kids there. He got into his car, he sat in his car, he wound down the window, and he spent 5 minutes... signing everything.
Yeah.
You know, backs of hands, bits of bus ticket. And I'm talking about this now 40 years later. Yeah. It was important.
Yeah.
It meant something. It takes very little time. I've never said no to an autograph. I mean, photographs you sometimes have to say, if it gets out, you say, okay, quickly, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but generally, no, because it's important and it doesn't make any difference to you to do. And also, if you're skilled enough at it, if somebody's a fan of yours and they're gawping a little bit and they don't know what to say, you can put them gently on a conveyor belt and they don't know they're on the conveyor belt. So you say, oh, hello, what's your name? You enjoyed it? Yes, fine. Can I have it? Have you got a phone? Yeah, your friend's got a phone. Hello, how are you doing? Good to see you. Nice to see you. Good luck. Enjoy the rest of it. And it's it, you know, and it's like 30 seconds, a minute or something.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely fine and it's not a problem. I just remember the disappointment of somebody it was a really good player. And this guy that signed was not the most glamorous player in the team by any stretch, but he was the only one that bothered.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, it was very nice. You were very nice. I think you sent me a letter once we were on TV.
It was a solicitor's letter.
It was, yeah.
Will you stop coming up to me? Oh, I'm a big fan of yours. I lived in Somerset. We didn't get horses till 1948.
I better ask you a couple of emergency questions, Paul, to get myself out of the embarrassment.
Sure.
I'm going to pick some at random. I won't ask you that. That's too mean. they're all terrible.
These emergency questions, they're not living up to their billing.
They aren't. I'll ask you this one first. Have you ever irked a postman?
Yes, I have. Yeah. I was doing sort of like, you know, the delivery, newspaper deliveries during the week, and there was this postman. We used to go down in sort of cul-de-sac little flats here and there, and occasionally the postman would give me letters. You know, if you're going to number 34, can you post that through the thing, you know? So one time I tried to give him a Daily Express to post at number 54. I'd got it wrong, the relationship between me and the postman. I thought, you know, I was 12 years old, he was like double my age, 30 or something like that, you know, pals together in the workplace, walking the same streets, you never know how heavy the next package is going to be. I remember one day delivering the Daily Express, Martin Bormann found on every single newspaper, because the Express were convinced in 1973 they'd found Martin Bormann. Anyway, enough of this topical material. Martin Bormann, fuck. I was talking about Alexei doing Mussolini. I'm now working Martin Bormann material.
How about this? I've never asked anyone this question. I'll never ask anyone again. Mm. Would you rather be able to turn your head like an owl or have a neck that telescopes up to the length of a giraffe's neck but can go back down again to normal?
Oh, no,
will.
Definitely the second one.
Yeah, the neck.
Yeah, yeah, because you can always do that.
Yeah. It's a bad question.
Is this on? You went to a good school, didn't you? What the fuck do they teach them?
So let's talk about Just a Minute.
Yes.
Which I was, again, as was for you, I was when I was a young man and a student, I would listen to that in the kitchen and dream of being on it, and then you've managed to through the scruples you managed to your way in.
Meeting Nicholas, yeah, it is, it's wonderful. Kids generally like Just a Minute; they get it because it's very easy to understand what you can't do. You know, it is difficult because certainly in the nature of public speaking or comedy, repetition, hesitation, deviation are all part of what you do. Yeah. You know, so to suddenly not do that is a bit of a challenge. I mean, Ross is an excellent player of the game, but on the last show that I heard last week, at one point he said, week after week after week. So I always liken it to golf, you know. It doesn't matter how good you are, you'll always hit a bad shot, you know. Yeah. You can't master it. And the point is not to master it. The point is for the interventions and the challenges and all that sort of stuff. That's what it's about.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
I think the first time I did it, the first thing I said was, I've been so worried about repetition that I'd forgotten about hesitation. It's juggling the three things together.
Yeah.
But the second, you appeared on the second most... Apart from Nicholas, of course, who's appeared, I think, on pretty much every single one.
Yes, he has. No, he hasn't never missed one. Nicholas Parsons, actually, I don't know if you're aware of him, but he's actually one of the few entertainers working today. It's mentioned in the Bible.
Do you think...
Last Supper, he was doing the cabaret.
If the impossible and unthinkable happened and Nicholas was, for some reason, unable to carry on doing it...
Mm.
Would you be prepared to step over to the?
Oh no, I don't think so. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't host it because then you'd be sort of losing me as a contestant as well, or panelist, whatever we are. No, I think it will sort of. I mean, I'd had a meeting with somebody that said, you know, could I record something for Nicholas's obituary? You know, so if he suddenly died, they've got it there. And I said no. That was 12 years ago. The person who asked me left the BBC 5 years ago.
And is dead.
Yeah, no. Well, nobody lives after the BBC.
You do occasionally see obituaries that are written by someone who's already dead, don't you? Because they do get them out in advance.
That's
a bit weird, isn't it?
It does. Well, it seemed a bit... I think they were just worried, but, I mean, you know, it's just... They're not so worried now. He's clearly invincible. So.
I mean, it's just... The first time we did Just a Minute, he was up in Edinburgh and he had quite a busy day and he tripped over a speaker.
Ah, you were doing that one, yeah.
Yeah, in the first show. And he had a really bad fall and yet still got up and then did two episodes Just a Minute and he's so sharp on it nearly all the time.
No, I mean, he is completely... So, you know, at the age of 94 this year, Yes, indeed. Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock came out 4 months before he was born. 1923. Yes, but of course, Nicholas being Nicholas, the reason why he did fall over the speaker was he was hamming it up by looking at the audience as he came on. And not seeing where he was going. But no, he is, you know, the legs are getting a little slow for him now. But no, everything else is ticking along brilliantly. And it's just, he's brilliant casting for that. It's important, you know, it's important to have a chairman that says, no, you can't get away with that, whatever. You know, yeah. So it feels as if it's about something, but what it's really about is just having a laugh in a quiz or a parlour game format, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a... you talk about in your book about working with Peter Jones, which obviously you worked with him a lot on the show, but you did. He was in one of the Hancock ones you did. Mm. And he did a Fist of Fun episode. It was sort of so exciting. Again, I think I love comedy when it gets that intergenerational feel to it.
Well, yes, I mean, there is sort of in comedy, you know, people can still be respected at an age where in other professions they might not be, you know. So, yeah, it's Bruce Forsyth. I mean, people sort of laughed at him and stuff once, but no, I mean, I totally admire what he does. I mean, there was a moment in Strictly Come Dancing. I mean, they've had to change the format a bit because actually what he was doing was going for sort of like real loud out belly laughs live Saturday night BBC One. There was no sort of laughter machine that could come in, so now they've adjusted it a bit so it's not quite so naked, so the presenters don't have to come out and do a gag straight away because. Yeah. You know, the nature of doing a gag straight away, if it doesn't work, it kind of sets a tone. And so you've really got to be sure of what you're doing rather than risk. It's much better to say hello and welcome rather than da 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 da. You know, and then there's nothing. And then so they, you know, so it's better to be neutral.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, you were giving.
Have you ever seen the Bruce Forsyth and Norman Wisdom doing Sunday Night at London Palladium together? The
no,
two
I don't
of
think
them.
So.
It's on videotape or whatever they call it these days. just press a machine there and it comes out of your ear or something. But there is the two of them. There was an equity strike. They belong to the Variety and Artists Federation. So there was nobody could do the show apart from these two guys said they would do it live TV.
Right.
And Norman Wisdom's abilities, I mean, he has a sort of poor reputation, I think, perhaps sometimes, but his physical abilities as a comedian were astonishing. And live TV, he does a thing at one point, you've got a grand piano at this side of the stage over there, polished top. He runs from over here and jumps astride the grand piano on his belly, falls off, turns as he's falling, so he lands on his back.
Right.
And this is live TV. He does one other thing. If I can... can I stand up for a minute with this?
Yes.
He does this thing where he's just had a situation with somebody here. He walks backwards. He keeps walking back. He doesn't do what I'm doing. He doesn't look down. He stops, and he completely disappears down a trap door. And at no point has he looked to see where he's going. What he's done, because I looked back at it two or three times, is exactly 12 steps.
Yeah.
And he's an ex-army man.
Right.
So he's rehearsed it to the point where he knows, okay, I'm there. 12 steps back from here, all equal pace... blah, 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 gets me there, and he's gone. And what makes it funny, if he looks to see where he's going, we kind of guess something's going to happen. But
yeah.
He stands still and just disappears. Now, is there a comic today that could do that?
Well.
No.
No.
A circus clown might be able to do it, an acrobat might be able to do it, but that kind of... And this is, remember, it's live TV, and if he doesn't get it right, it's a size of this table, the trap door, and he disappears down.
Well, there was a lot. You know, there was a lot of craft in those, and a lot of them had worked on routines and
for
TV. They'd only do that would be all they did, wasn't it? One routine.
This was it. In those days, you could hone an act and do it. You could do the same act, you know, for 40 years or something. Like a 20-minute act or something. So yeah, people sort of settled into certain routines. So it wasn't necessarily better, but it was different.
Yeah. Would you rather
How tall is this giraffe?
You go really, I mean, you'd go, it'd be bad, you'd telescope up and you'd hit your head.
Yeah.
So maybe you should have chosen the owl after all.
No. I'm assuming I can see where I'm going as a giraffe, but should be able to see where I'm going.
Yeah, you have to think about these things. I remember the first Edinburgh I did was 1987, and I remember I was very excited about going to see your show, but I wasn't able to see your show that year.
No.
Because you've had in your book there's quite a lot of incidents where you've got ill or broken legs or had bad reactions to malaria medicines.
Yeah, yeah, yes,
and
absolutely.
And had periods of time where you've been put out of action. So you broke your leg in... You literally broke your leg going to Edinburgh.
Played football up at the... I went up to Edinburgh for the 87 festival, one-man show, did the opening night. That was okay, went all right. Fine, opening, it was all right. Went out, played football the next day, fell over, broke my leg. Went into hospital, which was luckily just up the road. Came out of hospital after about 3 or 4 days. Started getting really sort of sweaty and falling in and out of consciousness. Ambulance was called. I was round at somebody's flat because the flat that I'd been renting was right at the top of a huge block. So, my leg in plaster, I had to be lying on somebody's floor somewhere. The ambulance, for some reason, took 3 hours to arrive. They kept phoning for this ambulance. This was back in 87, so it was just a landline. I think we even had, people had mobiles. Maybe a few people had mobiles. The ambulance turned up eventually. I got into it. Andy Smart, who was with me, was just talking to me, and he came into me with the hospital. They thought, well, somebody should go in with me. So I then take to the hospital, and I'm lying on this hospital sort of trolley in a little sort of alcove bit. And Andy is keen to get a bet on the 4:30 race at York. And so he has a look at me, he looks at the time, and he just has a poke in to see when he sees the colour I am, and I'm sort of kind of sort of kind of bluey sort of colour. And he attracts the medical staff, and they whisk me off. And I wake up the next morning, and I've got these things going into my arm, little drips and things, and I've got an oxygen mask on. And I'm thinking, this is a funny sort of broken leg. It sort of seems to develop. And what that was a pulmonary embolism, which is a sort of blood clot which formed and went into my lung. Heart or brain, it's sort of that's it, really. But lung, you've got a sort of chance to survive. And so, spoiler alert, I did. and while I was in hospital as well, I contracted hepatitis A, which one of the doctors said, well, to be honest, you've probably caught it from the hospital food. So that was 1987. But I had the review. It said one review on the one show I did. It said, go and see this man. He's hilarious. And so people would queue up by the hospital bed. I'd show him me x-rays. Allow some of them to take a bit of blood, you know.
But I remember that being a big thing, and that was like, but
it was quite big.
It's 30, yeah, for you.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realise how close you'd come to paying.
Oh yeah, it was. I mean, and sort of, you know, medical professionals, you know, doctors, nurses are fantastic, but occasionally when you meet somebody that isn't, you go, oh, for fuck's sake, do you really have to be like that? And this guy came up to me after I woke up with the oxygen mask, and he said, I suppose you realise you nearly died last night. So what can you say to that? I'm awfully sorry to inconvenience you. So of course that, you know, it's a funny way to find out. Yeah. But so that was that. But that was sort of managed to get through it. And it was all about determination in the end, and just sort of getting better, and you know, just keep going. You know.
Yeah. But then you had also this. You had this incident where you had to go to the Maudsley Hospital after you...
Yes, indeed. Yes, I was... We did a Christmas version of Whose Line Is It Anyway. I was going on holiday. I went to Kenya, and I'd never been to Africa, and it turned out to be a bit of a mistake, because in terms of the medication I was taking this particular strong version of anti-malarial pills. Is it Larium, I think it might be called? It's something like that. And this was back in 1990, that new year. And I came back, I was convinced that I was being spied upon by where I lived in the bedsit in Streatham. If I looked across the rooftops, I saw 5-6 rooftops away, some builders on a rooftop, but they weren't really builders. Because I could tell they weren't builders, because they weren't doing much building. They kept looking to see where I was. So all this sort of thing was playing in your mind, you know. Taxi drivers were sort of, if the colour purple might suddenly mean something. It was just, I was just about to make this television series with Channel 4. Something was wrong. We couldn't figure out what it was. And I ended up being taken to the morgue by my girlfriend at the time, who was very worried about me. I became convinced that I knew what was going to be playing on the radio. The next song is going to be, and I couldn't say it because I didn't know what it was, and then it would come on, I'd say, I knew it was going to be that, you know, and stuff like that. And I got taken there on a Saturday, and this guy's trying to assess me, and I'm just sort of just buzzing. It was really extraordinary, sort of like, you know, started talking about, oh, my grandfather was an inventor. He invented a soft drink called Three Up, and then he made that better, and he called it Four Up. You can see where this is going. And then you got the six up and gave up then, and it's a shame. You know, all this stuff is coming out of me.
Yeah.
And it is, and so I went into the Maudsley, and the TV show got postponed for a year, which was fine. It happened another year later, that was fine. But it was, so you're in a situation where you don't know what it is. And it was his anti-malarial pills, and my psychiatrist noticed that my behaviour changed on a Friday. Because I was on a daily pill and a weekly pill. It was the weekly pill that was the problem.
Yeah.
And that was, it really, it was, I always think of it as being that big, but it wasn't. It was tiny, but the effect, it felt like it was that big. It just really knocked you out. And the first time I went in there, they were accidentally giving me the weekly pill every day for about 3 days. So that was something. In the canteen, going into the canteen in the morning for breakfast, you have a choice. You have sort of like a hard-boiled eggs, which have all been peeled, because there's no shell, so, you know, shell can be sharp and hard. There's sort of paper, cardboard plates and plastic knives and forks and all this sort of stuff. And one day there was a kid, I say kid, he was about 19, I suppose, I was about 30 then, and he'd recognised, because the thing was, not only was I in this psychiatric hospital, but Whose Line Is It Anyway was going out every Friday on Channel 4, and they were watching it in the hospital, you know. My psychiatrist that I was seeing in the hospital didn't watch it. He didn't know anything about it. It was very new at that point. So when he said to me, I said to him, well, some of the patients are looking at me a bit strange. He said, well, why would that be? And I said, well, because they see me on television on a Friday. Just Fridays, is that? So this boy next to me, he's sort of like, you know, we're queuing up for our sort of bran flakes or our hard-boiled egg, whichever mood we feel our digestive system is in. And this boy, he says to me, he taps me on the shoulder, he says, you're Paul Merton, aren't you? I felt responsibility, so I said, yes, I am, yeah. Don't tell anybody I'm here. It's a bit of a secret, but, you know, just I'll be quiet. Oh, right, I won't tell anybody. And after I wrote the book, this was 30 years later, whatever it was, 25 years later, I was in Wimbledon, not too far away from the Denmark Hill, and this nurse came up to me, and she said to me that the guy I'd spoken to, his name was John, and it just helped him enormously because he realised that it wasn't his fault that he was there. That it could, and this is the thing about mental health, you know, one of the things is that sort of when it happens to people, there is a sense, sometimes a sense of shame. If you can get rid of that shame, it's really helpful. But it really helped him,
sure.
You know, to sort of see that a man on the television, if he can be ill, then I can be ill, and it's not my fault, it's not a weakness. I mean, all equally, when he said to me, are you Paul Merton? I could have said, yes, and I've jumped out of the telly. I'm not denying that there wasn't a temptation.
No.
But, you know, in those situations. But it was really good just to find out that actually there was amidst the sort of, like, difficult times for me, there was beneficial stuff happening around, you know, as well.
Yeah, but also, when I kind of find it fascinating, because I think with comedy anyway, as a comedian, you're playing around on that. You're walking a tightrope between sanity and insanity in a way, right? I mean, so those jokes...
Well, imagination...
Those things you're saying
suppose,
are sort of jokes, aren't they? But they're... So a joke isn't too far away from, you know, allowing yourself to...
You're changing
to jump
reality
over.
Or you're usurping reality or doing something that sparks a comic reaction, yeah.
And I think sometimes you're playing... I feel that sometimes, you know, I play myself at snooker 80 times in my basement. Mm. And, you know, I'm in control of
on
it.
On a 6x3 table.
On a 6x3 table, and I commentate on it myself.
I don't know, 5-year-olds that give you a game?
Right. My daughter's nearly old enough now.
Oh, yeah.
And I think also that's the weird thing about being a celebrity. I mean, sort of being, you know, a newish celebrity, that if you are in a kind of paranoid state and you think people are watching you and talking about you, they are a little bit as well.
I back in 87, which was when I had all the broken leg stuff, the show that you saw, Comedy Wavelength, on Channel 4, it ran for 10 weeks, so I got a chance to build an audience up over the course of, you know, 2.5 months. It's a long time. So it went from 3 million to 4, I think, or something like that. But one of the first times I sort of, it affected my behaviour, and I realised afterwards just how silly and laughable the whole thing was. I'd left my sort of one-bedroom flat in Streatham, and I was walking down Streatham High Road towards Dadbury Smith's. I got there, and there was two sort of young women who sort of saw me and started giggling and pointing, and I felt embarrassed. So I left W.H. Smith's, and they followed me out of W.H. Smith's. So I got on the bus to go back home. They got on the bus to get back home. Not to get back home with me. But yeah. And so I then got off the bus at a stop earlier, then ran down the road so they wouldn't be able to follow where I lived. Got home, sweated, heart palpitation. It had been 35 minutes since I'd left the house to buy a paperback book. I had no book. I was sweating in my living room on my own, and I'd done it completely to myself. And I realised that actually, the funniest thing is, the easiest thing is that people, all you want to do is just wave, and that's it. That's yeah. That people are just a moment of contact, just to say hello, oh, hello, you know, that's it. People are very happy with that, you know. Yeah. It's just, you know, thumbs up sort of thing, you know.
Yeah. And I'm very jealous of you because you've got, I was touring on one of my tours and I bumped into you in Brighton.
Yes.
And yeah. I drive myself around in a little VW Golf, and you've got a massive, proper tour bus that you travel around with your improv.
Well, there's a good reason for it, although it seems extravagant.
It's good. I could do it.
I mean, if there's five of us.
Yeah. It'd be weird if it's just me on my own in a bus, right?
Yeah. Well.
And driving it around myself.
They are fantastic. It is like having your own train that goes wherever you want it to go, because it's a double decker, so there's sleeping compartments, a kitchen, a screen for DVDs, you know, and all that sort of stuff. But it makes sense, essentially. If you sort of, like, if you're doing a gig in Leeds or somewhere like that, and you leave Leeds at 10:30, you can be back in London by 1:30, 2 in the morning, whatever it is, something like that. You haven't paid hotel bills for 5 people. It's better to get back to London, get back to your own bed and wake up there than it is to wake up in a hotel somewhere else.
Sure.
You know, so actually, although it looks completely over the top, it just about breaks. It makes about the same amount.
It looked like a lot of fun.
Oh, it's fantastic. No, really. And some venues, you know, like the backstage facilities aren't particularly great. I mean, here it's like a palace. I mean, this is nothing. You want to see what it's like back there. Prince Charles comes back here, doesn't he, when he wants to feel somewhere posh. You want to see it back here. It's wonderful. Anyway, but yeah, so it, sometimes some of the venues aren't particularly good, and so you could use the bus as a, you know, you get a higher Indian takeaway or something.
Yeah.
So you sit on the bus and just say it's all very sociable. With a group of you making up improv, making up comedy for 2 hours, it helps if you all get on really well.
Of course.
That's the key thing, really. I've been in improv groups where 2 people haven't got on well, and every scene they do is an argument. It happens within moments. So, you know, it might be a joyous occasion, the birth of a new baby. Oh, what a beautiful baby. Oh, yes, you'd know all about babies, wouldn't you, since you killed those children all those years ago. What do you mean? You know, you were the one, you know, whatever. So, yes, it's sort of, you have to have harmony, because you can always you can always play anger, but you can't always fake joviality.
But your partner, your wife, is in the group as well.
Suki, yeah, Suki. Absolutely.
So, I mean, there must be times when you've had a little tiff, maybe?
Little tiff. What are these questions from 1956? Have you had a little tiff, Marilyn Monroe? Well, no, it's easier, though, isn't it? Because if we do it, the thing about the improv is, there's no set script. So if you say to somebody afterwards who wasn't there, what was it like? Oh, it was this bit when the cowboy came on and then the, you know, and it doesn't sound like anything because it isn't anything. It's ephemeral. It's gone. If she's at home and I come home at 1:30 from Leeds, what was the show like? Oh, it was like this. You know, that's kind of potentially the breakup of a relationship because you're not doing the same thing at the same time. And there's no way of explaining it on social hours. If you're doing it together, then it's great. You know, it really works.
And would you go back to? I don't think you will, but will you go back to stand up? Or is it?
I loved stand up when it was the when the early days of the cabaret circuit. When you'd be like 1 of 5 people on the bill, you know. So you're 1 of 5 acts. So you go to the bar afterwards with the other acts that have been on or haven't been on, and it was very sociable and all that. The thing about I've done it before, being on stage an hour. And just myself, and I don't like it. I want a comedy butler to come on. I want somebody to hand me a piece of paper that's completely blank and say to me something like, "You know what it means," or I don't know, but something that's not just the sound of my own voice. You know?
Yeah.
But other people are really skilled at that. But for me, I'm always looking for entrances and exits.
Yeah, I mean, I really understand what you mean, and I can see why you would prefer what you're doing, and you're awesome what you're doing. But it also seems a shame when you do that little bit of stand-up and everyone goes, oh, wow, that was good and exciting.
Yeah, but it's, you know, I mean, I always found it really difficult to write stand-up as well. I mean, that policeman on acid routine, as I called it, was something that still took 6 weeks to get. But, I mean, it used to take forever. I think really, during the 80s, the standard is like a 20-minute act. I think I had a really shit-hot 17 and a half minutes. I'm not sure I ever got to 20, because at the Comedy Store they have this light on stage which only the act can see, which is this red light that flashes on to tell you, you know, stop, you're going too far. And all the times I played the Comedy Store, I never saw that red light. And when it was explained to me, it had been there since 1979, I was gobsmacked. No, I never had but that was, it didn't come to me naturally. Improvising with other people, it's like ad-libbing at school or something where your mates, somebody says something, you base something on that, you react off that, somebody else says something. On your own, that's something I'm not so easy. I'm not very fluent.
No. Well, it's a I understand what you're saying. It seems like
so you want me to do a stand-up
tour? I want you to do a stand-up tour on your own.
So I can die on my arse. Yeah. You say, giraffe stuff. I don't know why he's still working now.
Drive your own bus around.
Drive my own bus around, yeah.
And do you think have I got news for you going to carry on for forever?
No, it's going to stop next week forever. I shouldn't tell you that, really.
Are you still enjoying it? Because there was a point where you weren't enjoying it, I think.
That was a long time ago, but it's like one of these things, it's got such a huge audience that love the show, and it's sometimes it's hard to do, sometimes it's easy to do, but it's a dream gig, so, you know, it's one of those things, you can't afford to start getting sort of like, oh, God, I've got to do this again. Well, there's plenty of people who'd love to do it, so, you know, I only have to sort of, you know, say, you know, and it's important, you know, the morale boosting of comedy is very important. So the comedians have to kind of be up, I think.
Yeah. You know. All right, I'll ask you an emergency question at random.
Then we'll have to finish, because I've got to do another one.
Who are you interviewing next?
I'm interviewing next week. People are going to wait till next week. It's Joe Thomas from the In Between Us and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's nice. Seems like a nice lad. I've never met him, but I'll see him next week.
Here's a quick David Bowie story that I heard tell you tell once.
Okay.
He was doing in the early days of Ziggy Stardust. He's in one of his documentaries, so if you're a big Barry fan, you might already know this. Talking about backstage stuff, and he was talking about the early days of Ziggy Stardust and trying out some sort of tryout gigs, and they might have been somewhere sort of in the north, somewhere Hull, perhaps Huddersfield, somewhere like that, maybe. And working men's clubs, it's all a bit primitive backstage. And David's got all the Ziggy Stardust gear on, it's all sort of zipped up and everything, and he's just about to go on, and he says to the guy backstage, excuse me, where can I, is there a sort of, you see that sink at the end of the corridor? That's your loo. He says, I can't go there. And he says, listen, son, if it's good enough for Shirley Bassey, it's good enough for you.
Well, I think we'll leave it on a laugh. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Paul Merton. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. And have a drink. Thanks very much. We'll be back in a bit, okay? You can go and buy one of those. Buy that.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. RichardHerring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com, you can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who's said hello so far. I do come and say hello after the show. If you enjoyed it, if you want to see me, that'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.